Recording in progress.
Hello, everybody. How are you? The sun came out just at the end of the sitting. Did you notice that? All of a sudden, the room brightened up. Yeah. So this afternoon or this evening, whatever time it is where you are, I want to go through this very long section that comes almost at the end of the sutra, where Sudana meets the final spiritual benefactors, Maitreya at great length, and then Manjushri. Manjushri was the first benefactor. He's also the last one. So this is noteworthy because Manjushri is the bodhisattva of wisdom, right? With the sword that cuts through. Everything okay, John?
No, your camera's off.
Oh, my camera's off. Oh, right. Oh.
Back on.
Right. So you guys were hearing my disembodied voice before? Right? Now you're all frozen, so I was disembodied and now you're frozen. But you guys aren't frozen, so hi. Anyway, I was saying Manjushri is the bodhisattva of wisdom, and wisdom in this case is a very specific, we all know this, a very specific kind of wisdom, the wisdom that understands the empty nature of all phenomena, the boundless nature of all phenomena, the fundamental reality that there actually, as much as it looks like it to us, there actually are no things in the world. There are no separate things. The idea of objects in the world that we perceive is completely illusory. And actual reality is the free flow, the evanescent, ungraspable flow of reality. And because reality is actually like that, because there's no boundaries or distinctions that are actually not illusory, that is in itself transcendent love. That's what love is, the free-flowing, mutual connection, mutual involvement of everything with everything and nothing with nothing. So nothing exists as such. Everything is only love. And that's why the emptiness of all dharmas, which sounds a little bleak from the point of view of wanting there to be things, is actually not at all bleak. It's actually quite wonderful. And that's why emptiness and love and compassion and the wish to benefit all beings forever with tireless, infinite energy, all this bodhisattva project is all kind of naturally, simply flows from the nature of reality according to these teachings. So it makes sense that it would be Manjushri who is the one who sends Sudana on his spiritual journey, and it would be also sensible that when he completes the journey, he would return to Manjushri. It's also fitting that Maitreya is the Buddha who appears here at the end of this very long list of spiritual benefactors. And I'm not sure if this is the longest section of the sutra, but it might be. It's about maybe 50 pages long or something like that. And it ushers in a very brief moment when he sees Manjushri again, and then comes the 10 vows of Samantabhadra, which is the sort of conclusion of the sutra. And that's what we're going to do next week. Will be our last week on the sutra when Jean will be here, and there'll be lots of you sharing in the vows of Samantabhadra. Maitreya is the Buddha of the next eon. He's the Buddha of the coming era, the era that has not yet dawned and that will dawn. And Maitreya comes from the Sanskrit word Maitri, which is the same as the Pali word metta. Maitri means love or loving kindness, friendliness, sometimes it's translated. And Cleary usually uses the word love. Maitreya is the coming Buddha in an age in which love will be the primary force. And so he has a pivotal role in the sutra. And you could say, now that we're coming to the end, you could say that really the whole sutra, in its broadest sense, is a passionate argument for replacing or reinterpreting or reconfiguring the idea in Buddhism of nirvana or enlightenment or awakening or peace to be, in fact, love as the central goal of Buddhist practice. So in one section that we're going to look at, we will see Maitreya praising Suddhana for his bodhicitta, pages and pages of praise for Suddhana because he has such a wonderful bodhicitta, the bodhicitta being the impulse, the thought of awakening, the passionate determination for awakening on behalf of all beings. And in the sutra and in Mahayana Buddhism in general, bodhicitta, which existed in early Buddhism but wasn't nearly emphasized so much, in Mahayana Buddhism, it is emphasized above all else. It even seems to be more important than awakening. Sort of seems odd that the determination to awaken would be more important than awakening, but that's sort of the way it is in Mahayana Buddhism. And I think that's because in Mahayana Buddhism, the recognition is that it is not so much awakening that is important, it's the determination to go on awakening that is important. And that's because awakening is understood not to be a state or an achievement or an insight or an endpoint, but an ongoing, limitless path. And this really reminds me of Dogen, who's all the time talking about going beyond Buddha, not being limited in our practice to Buddha or awakening, but going beyond that, which is to say continuous and endless practice with an altruistic motivation to be connected to and loving and protecting and caring for all of reality. And so another thing that's mentioned a lot in the sutra, I think we've talked about it before, is the idea of the bodhisattva's quest for omniscience. And we were noting that omniscience doesn't mean having all the facts, you know, having all the knowledge. It means unlimited concern and unlimited and equal regard for all beings. So this is a really radical thing, you know, that like some people say, let's be concerned for our family, let's be concerned for people in our country, let's be concerned for the people that we like, the people that we value, or the opposite, let's be concerned for unfortunate people, and that the people who are not unfortunate, we're not concerned about them. But here, it's radically, no, absolute concern and equal concern for all beings, all kinds of beings, regardless of their situation. And in that sense, it's unlimited without bounds, taking in everything, knowing in the sense of loving, merging with everything, in that sense, omniscience. So compassion, omniscience, bodhicitta, continuous practice, all kind of merged together as the defining element of the bodhisattva path. And also corollary, and another central theme in the sutra, again, as we've said before, is devotion to spiritual benefactors. And when you think about it, in the light of all of what I just said, doesn't that make sense? That every being would be a spiritual benefactor. All the beings we want to save and to love and to protect and fully identify with are spiritual benefactors. And every encounter we have with every being all the time is like Suddhana coming to greet and study with each of the 53 spiritual benefactors in the sutra. And there are so many expressions in the sutra of bodhisattvas always paying homage to spiritual benefactors and appreciating their teachings and putting them into practices and so on and so on. So now that we're almost at the end of the sutra, I think we can see that these are the main themes. Devotion to spiritual benefactors, endless determination for enlightenment for the benefit of others, passionate engagement in many, many spiritual practices for the purpose of benefiting unlimited suffering beings in a vast, cosmic, multidimensional, and simultaneous universe. That's what the sutra is about. And the reason I say that is because it's sort of interesting, because what the sutra is famous for and what you'll always read in the textbooks that it's really about is not that, but the teaching of interpenetration, which it is about, too. That all things are in each thing, and each thing includes all things. That all times are in every moment, and every moment includes all times, without anything bumping into anything else. You'd think with all of that interpenetration, there would be things get mixed up, but they never get mixed up. And each thing and each moment retains its individuality. That is a profound teaching that's in the sutra. But if you reread the sutra, and it's my time, this is the second or third time I've read it, and this time reading it, it struck me that actually, although the Huayan school of Chinese Buddhism took that teaching out of the sutra and made it, you know, the definition of what the sutra was about. In fact, when you read the sutra, that's a feature of it for sure, an important feature, but it's not really all about that. It's really all about the bodhisattva's heart. So now I'm going to go through these 50 pages, and then after that, Shufi has a word, literally a word she wants to share with us that she finds in the sutra to be meaningful, the word abandonment, which is an important word in the sutra. And then, we'll do that. And then after that, we're just going to have a little pause while our Enos set us up for the Bodhisattva ceremony. And isn't it a good thing to do tonight? And as I always say, all of our Zen ceremonies are enactments of the imaginative realm of the Mahayana Sutras. When we do a Zen ritual, we're like in the middle of a Mahayana Sutra. We're living in the middle of one. And the Bodhisattva ceremony, as we know, consists of first the verse of confession, which is the first thing you have to do to purify the space and purify the heart. And then we're going to invoke and pay homage to the infinite Bodhisattvas. I think we only mentioned 6 or 7 of them, but it stands for all the Bodhisattvas and all the sutras who come into the room to be with us so that we can perform the ritual. And then we'll do the 4 vows, which express our commitment to continuous practice forever and ever, right? And then after that, the triple refuge, which are the first 3 of the 16 bodhisattva precepts, and then we'll recite the other 13 precepts. So that's how we'll fittingly end our evening tonight. And the whole time we're doing all that chanting, we're bowing, and there's a lot of bows in the Bodhisattva ceremony, and that's how this Maitreya chapter begins, with Sudana bowing, profoundly bowing to Maitreya's tower, because this is, now we have the tower, Maitreya's tower, Vairochana or Maitreya's tower, that Sudana enters and sees finally the vision, immediately sees the vision of awakening. So Sudana now is going to visit Maitreya, and the first thing he does is he thinks of past activities inconsistent with the practice. So that's the way it starts, right? First of all, we begin to notice all the ways we think and behave and do that are inconsistent with what we're trying to do in practice. And we notice these for many years, right? past activities inconsistent with proper conduct, controlling his thoughts by thinking of past mundane mental behavior not conducive to purification of body and mind, contemplating the greater common weal in the present by thinking of the vanity of past involvement in harmful mundane activity, establishing the power of forming correct ideas by the practice of enlightening beings by thinking of former untrue ideas that he had had. And after, and lots of that goes on, and after all of that, he thinks of the positive side. In this frame of mind, with these thoughts, engaged in such reasoning, and with faith in the grace of all enlightening beings, with admiration for the determination of all enlightening beings, with respect for the determination of all enlightening beings, with reverence for the purity of the senses of all enlightening beings, so on and so on. He contemplates all that he sees ahead of him in his practice, all the good things. His mind pursuing such thoughts of respect, reverence, honor, submission, regard, empowerment, and determination, with the eye of knowledge intent upon the ground of the realm of such infinite knowledge, prostrated himself in front of the door of the great tower, chamber of the adornments of Vairochana, the illuminator. So he's come to this gigantic tower in front of him, and he just automatically throws himself to the ground and starts to do prostrations. And while he was prostrating, and this is like a kind of instruction for what we should, how we should orient ourselves, our minds, when we prostrate. Here's how he does it. He projects himself continuously while he's prostrating into the presence of all Buddhas, and likewise into the presence of all enlightening beings, to the abodes of all spiritual benefactors, and to all monuments to Buddhas, to all statues of Buddhas. While he prostrates, he projects himself, so he's no longer himself there prostrating to this tower. He's projecting himself into the hearts and minds of the Buddhas that he's prostrating to. And just as he prostrated himself before the great tower of the chamber of adornments of Vairochana, in the same way, he prostrated himself before all the aforementioned beings and objects throughout the cosmos. So in the prostration, everything is there. In this way, continuously, mystically manifesting the eons of the endless future, by equanimity, like an infinity of space, equanimity, like the non-obstruction of the realm of reality, equanimity toward the omnipresent, ultimate limit of reality, the equanimity of absence of false notions in those who realize thusness, and so on and so on. And here, equanimity, remember, doesn't mean peacefulness per se. It means an equal feeling, a feeling that is positively generated toward each and everything without boundary and without preference. He then realizes that all the Buddhas and all these visions come from us. He says, it all comes, the three vehicles come to be according to accumulation of spiritual practices, believing that the appearance of all Buddhas comes from faith, believing that the creations of offerings to Buddhas come from devotion, believing that all protections of Buddhas derive from respect, believing that the nature of all Buddhas derives from the accumulation of virtues, believing that all arrays of mental adornments derive from wisdom and technique, believing that all Buddha teachings derive from vows. In other words, all these things that through the whole sutra he's been observing and having faith in, he realizes here they all come from our vows and our faith. There's no Buddhas without our practice. With conscious thought accomplishing entry into knowledge in this way, Suddhana prostrated himself before the great tower, the chamber of adornments of Vairochana. So all that is in effect describing his prostration. After a long while, his being, flooded by the energy of inconceivable roots of goodness, his body and mind refreshed, he rose from the doorstep of the tower, gazed with unblinking eyes at the great tower containing the adornments of Vairochana, circled it respectfully hundreds of thousands of times. So now he circumambulates the tower, and he voices these thoughts. And now we have many pages of him saying, "What is this tower? This is the abode of those who dwell in the state of emptiness, signlessness, and wishlessness. This is the abode of those who dwell in the state of non-conceptualization of all things, those who dwell in the state of the unity of the cosmos, those who dwell in the state of the ungraspability of the realm of beings," skipping a bunch, "those who dwell in the state where one eon enters all eons," and here's the interpenetration teaching, "those who dwell in the state of the totality of one land and all lands as one land, those who dwell in the state where one thing and all things and one thing, harmonize without conflict. This is the abode of those who have dropped all attachments to the world, yet appear in the abode of all beings in order to develop them to maturity." So they have no attachment to the world, as if the world has disappeared, and yet they appear in the world to benefit others. "This is the abode of those who dwell in a state that is void of signs, yet do not enter the unchangeability of individual illuminates." So this is saying that they fully recognize that there are no things, but they do not leave this realm of things in order to become awakened, like to enter into nirvana. They remain anyway. "Those who dwell in the abode of non-origination of all things and yet do not fall into the condition of non-origination. Those who dwell in a state of love, who dwell on the four immeasurables and yet do not go into the world of pure form." So there are all these sort of Buddhist realms where you fully escape the painful world. They don't do that. They engage in all those practices, but they don't take them to the level of disengagement from the world. They remain engaged in the world. They have no wishes at all, and yet they don't give up ever their vows of enlightening beings. They can control all afflictive emotions, yet for the sake of developing sentient beings, appear to act under the influence of afflictive emotions. They have ended death and birth by perfect knowledge, and yet they are born and die, etc. Then, so that's Sudana speaking about the tower. This is the tower, these are the people who live in this tower. And then he begins to speak these verses. Many pages of verses in praise of Maitreya and this tower. Much of which repeats a lot of these things. This is the abode of the companion. And here, you know, there's lots of verse in this section. And verse is for the purpose of elevated speech of praise. That's what verse is, elevated speech, you know, praising reality. "This is the abode of the compassionate ones who radiate love to extinguish all the ills of all the beings in the miserable states of views, suffering, grievous pains." And then these beings who do that are given many metaphors to describe the way they are. They're like the leaders of a caravan, they're like invincible warriors, like master physicians, they're like mariners, you know, ferry people across. They're like giant birds who watch the abode of all beings. They're steadfast, they have an adamant will, they have oceans of intellect, they're unobstructed in their actions, they have minds of all virtues, they have unobstructed eyes, perfect in virtue, unattached and unhindered in action, etc., 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 etc. And the verses end with, I bow in respect to the abode of the blameless ones. And the abode of the blameless ones is the tower. In the realm of non-obstruction, and to the noble Maitreya, best of enlightening beings, unhindered in action, incomparably pure in mind, and always aware. Having praised and honored the enlightening beings dwelling in the great tower of the chamber of adornments, Vairochana, in this way, with innumerable eulogies of enlightening beings, Sudana stood at the foot of the tower, wishing to see the great enlightening being, Maitreya. And then he saw Maitreya outside the tower, coming from somewhere else. Maitreya wasn't even in the tower. He comes from somewhere else. And there's an interesting little comment on this phrase, coming from somewhere else, that you wouldn't necessarily, this gives you an idea of like Buddhist commentaries, like all religious commentaries can be quite amusing and unexpected. Let's see, what page is it on here? Yeah. Right. It's on page 80, okay. Coming from somewhere else means that when adapting to conventions in order to teach people, one does not dwell on one's own rewards. One does not dwell on one's own rewards. Who would have guessed that it would mean that, right? Well, anyway, he's coming from somewhere else, and he appears, followed, of course, by a great number of beings and all kinds of gods and guardians. Seeing Maitreya, Sudana was uplifted in mind, very happy and joyful, and prostrated himself again to Maitreya from afar. And then Maitreya, seeing Sudana, pointed him out to the crowd that he had come with, and he spoke these verses, eulogizing the virtuous qualities that Sudana had actualized. And now comes many pages of poetry praising Sudana, but mostly praising him for his bodhicitta, his determination for awakening. Welcome, son of compassion and love, universally kind. Welcome, tranquil eyes. Do not flag in practice. Welcome, pure of heart, tireless in mind. Welcome, buoyant in sense. Do not flag in practice. Having set out to contemplate all truths, guide all beings, and follow all spiritual benefactors, you are welcome with your unshakable, steadfast resolve. Your heart is pure, free of guile and deceit, a good receptacle, free from pride and conceit, free from anger, not arrogant. You are a welcome sight. So he's really happy to see him. And just so, you know, imagine somebody you haven't seen in a long time that is a wonderful person. You're so happy to see them. You are a welcome sight. And I will show you, come into the tower, and I will show you the unimpeded realm. See this net of vows pervading the cosmos? So that, you know, Indra's net, which is often the image of the interpenetration, I don't know that it's mentioned in the sutra. I can't remember whether it is, but it turns out that it's a net of vows. It's a net of vows pervading the cosmos inconceivably, spreading it, drawing forth the path of enlightening practice. And then he says, Sudana comes with these thoughts. Enlightening beings increase my wisdom and grant me enlightenment. They are praised by the Buddha. He's now telling us what Sudana thinks. He thinks, these are my parents. These are my physicians. These are like polar mountains, these enlightening beings. These are like givers of fearlessness. These are like reliable caravan leaders, and so on and so on. All many, many metaphors. And he says, Sudana is here because he wants to break the repetitious cycle of conditioning with the adamantine knowledge that breaks the mechanism of suffering and the circle of conditioning. And he will light the lamp of truth, the pure wick of truth. Rejoice, Sudhana, rejoice, for you will, he's now predicting Sudhana's Buddhahood, all you've done and all of your devotion, you rejoice, because you will illumine the various aspects of reality, illumine the various aspects of the world, and reach the goal of the various aspects of all truth. As your behavior is mild, as your faith is impeccable, as your intention is virtuous, you shall fulfill all your vows, and you will see all the Buddhas very soon. And so forth. And it goes on for many pages. Then Maitreya, seeing Sudhana arrive, imbued with virtues in the realm of non-obstruction, revealed him to the assembly, speaking of his treasury of qualities. Sudhana, hearing such supreme direction and instructions, was flooded with joy and immediately burst into tears. I love it when the bodhisattvas burst into tears. They're so overjoyed and so moved by all this that they just burst into tears. They can't help themselves. So he does that. Then by the mental power of Manjushri, there appeared in his hands, in Sudhana's hands, beautiful flower gardens and jewels produced by the vows of enlightening beings. And blissfully, Sudhana threw them all over Maitreya, because he needed something. He just had to do something. It was just too overwhelming. So these flowers and jewels appeared, and he was able to fling them all over Maitreya. And he said, it is hard to find, this is Sudhana, it's hard to find, even in hundreds of lifetimes, such friends as these whom I have now met. It is good for me to have come here today. Then Sudhana stood respectfully before Maitreya and said, noble one, just like he does with every benefactor now, he asks the question, right? Every benefactor, he asks them, how do I practice? So now he says, noble one, I have set out for supreme perfect enlightenment, but I do not know how an enlightening being is to learn and carry out the practice of enlightening beings. You would think after 52 benefactors, he would be beginning to get the story, but no. He has to ask the same question every time as if nothing had ever happened before. So he does, he asks the same question. And please tell me, noble one, how an enlightening being is to learn and carry out the practice of enlightening beings, by which practice an enlightening being attains enlightenment. And so Maitreya, looking over the whole crowd, pointed out Sudhana and said, good people, look at this fine young man who asks me about the perfection of the virtues of enlightening practice. With his diligence and so on and so on and so on, he left his city in search of spiritual benefactors at the direction of Manjushri and traveled south, inquiring of 110 spiritual benefactors, until finally he has come to me, his mind thoroughly unwearied. What? 110 spiritual benefactors? Where did that come from? Well, we consult our commentary. Why is it 110 when we know perfectly well that it's really 53? In the realm of principle, reality, true reality, Manjushri stands for knowledge of the fundamental, which means emptiness. Manjushri stands for knowledge of the fundamental. Samantabhadra, who we're going to encounter at the very end, and Samantabhadra's vows, Samantabhadra stands for knowledge of differentiation. That's the activity required in a world. Once there's a world in beings, a lot of stuff goes on. And Maitreya is the bodhisattva of all of that stuff, whereas Manjushri is the bodhisattva of the fundamental. And Maitreya stands for the uncreated realization within Manjushri and Samantabhadra. So somehow Maitreya is the union of emptiness and activity, which is love, right? So these three are very intimately connected to one another. Now, here's how we get to 110. These three are all in the 50 spiritual friends, representing the five ranks of enlightenment that Sudana meets on his pilgrimage. So there are 53 teachers. So now it's separating out these three from the other 50, right? Since the 50 teachings of the spiritual friends each has cause and effect, right? So each teacher is both a cause and an effect, and everything is both a cause and an effect in this world. Since that's true, you multiply 50 times 2, and you get 100, factoring out those three, right? 50 times 2 is 100. Add to this the basic 10 paramitas, the 10 ways of transcendence, which are mentioned a million times in the sutra over and over again, and that makes 110. And that's the number of cities that Sudana passes through, and that's why there are 110 benefactors, even though there are really 53. I thought that was amusing and worth repeating. So, and it's hard to even hear the names of these benefactors, to see them in person or to share their practice. Why is that? Because this sincere good person has set out to save all beings, undertaken to liberate all beings from misery, to evaporate all bad tendencies, to put an end to all states. And in other words, this does not that many people like this person, and that's why it's kind of rare. This person wants to abandon passion for joy, to remove the fetters of views, to rescue beings from the four torrents. And the four torrents are kama, bhava, avijja, and drishti. Kama meaning passions, bhava meaning desire to go on living, and avijja is ignorance, and drishti is views. Those are the things that keep us going round and round in our suffering. Kama, bhava, avijja, and drishti. So he rescues beings from those four torrents and produces a light of knowledge for people in darkness. He's all describing how great Sudana is. He wishes to give the element of immortality to those assailed by birth, old age, and death. He wants to cool the three fires of greed, hate, and delusion. He wants to tell those surrounded by the serpents of the elements how to escape, to those loitering in the ghost town of the sense media. Is that great or what? The ghost town of the sense media. He wishes to show the way out by the light of wisdom. Those on wrong paths, he wishes to lead into the right path. To the friendless, he wants to show true spiritual friendship. Those clinging to the realm of the infantile, unenlightened condition, he wishes to initiate into the teachings of the sages. So he wants to do this for everyone. In all the world, it is hard to find people who have that kind of aspiration. So he's praising Sudana's tremendous aspiration and altruism and desire to be of service, fundamental and ultimate service to sentient beings. Then Maitreya, having eulogized the true virtues of Sudana and thereby strengthened the determination for enlightenment in hundreds of thousands of people, so, like, was it last time we were here together? Wasn't it last time that we had the ceremony for Sue?
Yes.
Right? So, but then we realized that when you have a ceremony for somebody, it's not that person, right? In having the ceremony for that person, you strengthen the determination for enlightenment in hundreds of thousands of people, see? So it's not like Sue, like, won the prize for like running the fastest mile in history, and she's a tremendous runner. No, she was just a stand-in for hundreds of thousands of people whose determination for awakening was strengthened by her willingness to undergo that little ritual. And all of our rituals, Jukai and all those rituals are like that. That's the point of them. It's good that you have set your mind on supreme perfect enlightenment for the welfare and happiness of all worlds. By this intent of yours, you have developed the determination for supreme perfect enlightenment. So that's sort of the summation of all the things that he's been saying. And then comes about 12 or 15 pages of metaphors to describe how great this is. So this determination for enlightenment, this bodhicitta, is really so great that we have to go on for many, many pages to try even remotely to describe how great it is. So it's the seed. It's a seed of all the elements of Buddhahood. It's a field growing all the good qualities in all beings. It's like the earth. It's like water, and each one of these is described. It's like the earth, it's like water, it's like wind, it's like the sun, a lamp, a road, an eye, a passageway, a vehicle, a mansion, a park, a home. Father, mother, king, overlord, ocean, polar mountains, surrounding mountains, Himalayas, intoxicating fragrance, lotus, elephant, horse, charioteer, medicine, thunderbolt, chest of incense, great flower, cooling sandalwood, moon, medicine, chief of gods, god of wealth, goddess of beauty, the conflagration that ends an eon, medicine for underdevelopment, dragon pearl, water-clearing jewel, wish-fulfilling jewel, desire-granting tree, horn of plenty, plow, power, scimitar, sword blade, banner of hero, axe, machete, surgical probe, extracting instrument, a hoe, like a surgeon, you know, like a thing that a surgeon uses to extract stuff, or maybe like the dentist that uses to pull out your teeth. You know, it's like that, you know, because it pulls out the bad tooth that's hurting of samsara, right? It's like a mine. It's like a fountain, it's like a mirror, it's like a white lotus, a great river, a chief water spirit, the root of life. It looks, each one of these is described. Now I'm just giving you the headline. The all-encompassing net, it's like health, it's like an antidote to poison, it's like a spell, an island of jewels, a family, a home, liquid metal, a honeybee, a road, a vessel. I wonder if they're aware that they're repeating some of these. They probably don't know, you know. A vessel, a rain, a magnet, an emerald, a drum that sounds the hour, like the time drum, you know, in Tassajara, that sounds the hour. Still clear water, enormous mountain, motivation, the savior, treasury, sky god, fire of Indra, monument for the world. And that is the list of the list of metaphors. And then it breaks into still another sort of version of this, where it starts describing all these different potions that cure various worldly ailments. And it likens bodhicitta to these different potions. Just as there is a medicine called fearless that prevents five perils, and they are that when you take this medicine, you're not burned by fire, you're not affected by poison, you're not wounded by weapons, and you're not swept away by water or suffocated by smoke. I guess they had some medicine that at least they claimed would do those things. Whether they did them or not, we don't know. But in that same way, an enlightening being who has taken the medicine of the will for omniscience is not burned by the fire of passion, not affected by the poison of objects, not wounded by the weapon of afflictions, not swept away by the torrent of existence, and not suffocated by the smoke of false discrimination. And then it goes on, and each one of these metaphors is very extended. There are many, many, many pages of these, quite a number of them. Just as there is a kind of tree that grows in an ocean, on all of which, from its roots to its flowers and fruits, all beings are at all times living. In the same way, the world is sustained by the process of enlightening, growing from the root of vows based on great compassion, from the initial aspiration for omniscience through the duration and ending of the true teaching. So that's the secret way that the world is supported by this net of vows. That's what keeps the world going. Little do we know, you know, that this is how everything continues to exist. And then this one that I'm sure our Zen ancestors took to heart. Just as millions of lamps can be lit from one lamp, without the one lamp being exhausted or diminished by all the lamps taking their flame from it, in the same way, from one lamp of the aspiration for omniscience, the lamps of aspirations for omniscience of all Buddhas of past, future, and present are lit. Yet the one lamp of aspiration for omniscience is not exhausted and shines undiminished by the lights of the lamps of aspiration to omniscience proceeding from it. And this is why, for sure, the Zen literature, when it was first began to be collected in China, was called Transmission of the Lamp. And it was all the Zen stories are, all the collection was called Transmission of the Lamp, and all the koan collections were taken from the Transmission of the Lamp literature. And so that was the idea, that every Zen teacher was a lamp that lit the other lamps, and all the lamps down through the generations were lit and continued. And the original lamp was not diminished or increased by lighting the other lamps, which is a strange but true physical fact, isn't it? Why would that be? But that's really what happens, right, with lamps. Anyway, I just thought that one was particularly interesting. But there's pages and pages and pages of these. Just as a fisher with knowledge of sea monsters is free from fear of any creatures of the sea and is safe from harm even in the mouth of a whale, in the same way, the enlightening being with the knowledge of the powerful determination of the aspiration for enlightenment is free from fear of all the actions and afflictions of the mundane whirl and cannot be annihilated even in the midst of realization of individual liberation because of not falling into the extinction produced by witness of ultimate reality. So these enlightening beings, they go on and on and on, and they remain, in effect, unenlightened, even though there's nothing beyond their attainment, but they just keep on going. Anyway, as I'm saying, this is the ultimate point, the Maitreya's tower, and that tower and all these words about Sudana have to do with bodhicitta. It's all about bodhicitta. And one of the themes in here that I won't read any of it, but is, as we've seen elsewhere in the sutra, that somebody, I think Philip, complained bitterly about this in one of our sessions, and it's a feature of all Mahayana sutras, that they sort of make fun of or denigrate the early Buddhist practitioners, the practitioners of the Pali Canon, and they don't mean any harm by it, you know. They really don't. They're just trying to tell you how great this practice is and how, you know, overwhelmingly great it is. But you could, if you were a practitioner of those other schools and you were to take that personally, you might be offended, but we're not offended. Just as a goose feather robe is not stained by any dirt, the goose feather robe of the aspiration for enlightenment is not stained by the dirt of afflictions of the mundane world. Anyway, we come to the end of all of that after many, many pages, and then we say, this is still Maitreya, I think, talking. The aspiration for omniscience has these and untold other, that was just a very small part of, untold other extraordinary virtues, and those who have set their minds on supreme perfect enlightenment are, have been, and will be endowed with all these virtues. Therefore, you have made a great gain, Sudana, in having aspired to supreme perfect enlightenment and seeking the practice of enlightening beings because of attainment of these virtues. Also, you asked how an enlightening being is to learn and carry out the practice of enlightening beings. Well, go into the tower and look, and then you'll know how to learn the practice of enlightening beings and what kind of virtues are perfected in those who learn this. Then Sudana respectfully circumambulated the enlightening being Maitreya, it doesn't say how many times, and said, please open the door of the tower and I will enter. So then Maitreya went up through the door of the tower containing the adornments of Vairochana, and with his right hand snapped his fingers, poo, and the door of the tower opened and Maitreya beckoned Sudana inside, and in greatest wonder, he went into the tower. And as soon as he went in, the door shut behind him. He's not going out anytime soon. What did he see in the tower? He saw the tower immensely vast and wide, hundreds of thousands of leagues wide, as measureless as the sky, as vast as all of space, adorned with countless attributes, countless canopies, banners, pennants, jewels, garlands of pearls and gems, moons, half moons, multicolored streamers, jewel nets, gold nets, strings of jewels, jewels on golden threads, sweetly ringing bells and nets of chimes, flowers showering, flowers raining from the sky, you know, celestial garlands and streamers, censers giving off fragrant fumes, and on and on and on. But here's the other thing. Also, inside the great tower, he saw hundreds of thousands of other towers, just like this one. And he saw those towers also as infinitely vast as space, evenly arrayed in all directions, yet those towers were not mixed up with one another, being each mutually distinct while appearing reflected in each and every object of all the other towers. Then Sudana, seeing this, immediately was full of joy and bliss, and his mind was cleared of all conceptions and freed from all obstructions and stripped of all delusions. He became clairvoyant without distortion. He could hear all sounds with unimpeded awareness. And so everywhere he bowed in all directions with his whole body. He was so overcome with this experience. Now, here's what happened when he bowed. By the power of Maitreya, when he bowed, he perceived himself in all those towers. He was in all those towers. And in every one, he saw miraculous and diverse and inconceivable scenes. And now, those various scenes are described in many pages. In one tower, he saw where the enlightened being Maitreya first aspired to supreme perfect enlightenment. In another tower, he saw where Maitreya first attained absorption in love, where he got his name. In another tower, he saw where he carried out spiritual practice. So it looks like all of these towers, he's seeing various things that Maitreya experienced in Maitreya's practice. So it describes all those towers and all the things. In another tower, he saw Maitreya circumambulating ceaselessly for hundreds of thousands of years. In another, he saw him engaged in recitation. In another, engaged in contemplation of doctrine. In another, engaged in exposition of doctrine. In another, engaged in writing down the teaching. In another, absorbed in concentration on universal love. In another, absorbed in all the meditations and immeasurables. In another, absorbed in the points of totality and liberations. In another tower, he saw Maitreya absorbed in the practice of bringing forth the higher knowledge of enlightening beings. So those are a bunch of practices that we are subtly being told, hey, you guys should do those practices too. And then there's more practices that are given. So in the middle of the great tower containing the adornments of Vairochana, he saw one tower bigger than all the others and arrayed with adornments surpassing all the other towers. In that tower, he saw a billion world universe in which he saw 100 million sets of four continents, like this world is said to have four continents. That's the cosmology of this realm. But there was another 100 million realms with sets of four continents, with 100 million Jambudvipas, that's what they call this realm, and 100 million heavens of contentment. In those Jambudvipa continents, he saw the enlightening being, Maitreya, being born in a lotus calyx. He also saw Maitreya taking seven steps as Indra and Brahma watched, and so on and so on. And it's describing Buddha, the birth of a Buddha. So he saw Maitreya being born. He saw the next eon dawning in which the Buddha of love was now the Buddha. He saw that this birth. Then all the objects in all those towers, the nets of bells and chimes, the drums and songs and so on, and all the beings therein, thunder of a multitude of voices, all the objects spoke to him, and he could hear everything that he saw. And then it tells you what he heard, and then pages of that. He heard about setting out for omniscience in such and such a land. He heard another voice saying that in such and such a world, the enlightening being so and so makes so many hundreds of difficult sacrifices in the practice of transcendent giving. The enlightened being so and so keeps the precepts, cultivates the paramitas, and so on and so on. So he hears objects speaking to him about how to practice. And I think that's in Zen, you know, the way that Zen practice emphasizes the things in the, like ordinary, you know, like Oryoki is about paying attention, like to your spoon, right, which is the most precious thing, and is telling you, you know, all the secrets of awakening, and the chopsticks are telling you all the secrets of awakening and so on. All the objects of the world have a message, right? They're talking to you. Every single thing is telling. That's why you body your cushion, right? Your cushion is telling you all these things that you never would have expected. Anyway, it goes on and on. All the objects saying this and that. Flowers, reflections of countless moons, stars, suns, and planets. Another couple of pages of metaphors about how great all this is. And here the scene ends with this paragraph. So, Sudana saw these and other inconceivable projections of magnificent scenes from each of the towers and each object in the towers. By the power of unwavering awareness, by all-encompassing purity of vision, by unobstructed knowledge of observational skill, by attainment of control over the basis of knowledge of enlightening beings, standing on the ground of knowledge issuing from the perceptions of enlightening beings, he saw this whole endless manifestation of marvelous scenes. After which, many, many metaphors are given for what this was like, which I'm going to skip except for one, because one of them has to do with likening this scene to the final mental state before death. And so those of us who are old enough to have an active interest in death might be interested in this teaching. Here's what it says. It was like the case of a dying person hovering in their final mental state on the brink of the mental state immediately preceding rebirth, faced with a state of being which is caused by their actions. As a result of the accumulation of whatever actions they have done, they will see hell if he has done evil, or animals, ghosts, or the underworld may see angry, abusive henchmen of the underworld carrying weapons, or hear the cries of lament and anger of the beings in hell. They might also see the great hells burning, blazing masses of fire, and we'll see the copper cauldrons and the tortures being carried out, and we'll perceive those undergoing them. They might also see and feel the pains of the burning of the fires of hell. That's the bad news. But by the accumulation of good actions, they will see heaven and will see the assemblies of gods. And doesn't that make sense? Don't you believe that? Of course, if you have a very troubled mind because of all the adversity and fighting and struggle and defensiveness of your whole life, don't you think that it would be true that at the time that you were leaving this world, you would be disturbed? Conversely, if you had, like they say, a clear conscience and you had done your practice for a long, long time, you might still have some residue of that, but for sure it wouldn't be as bad, right? So sometimes they say that the whole of practice is just for that moment. That's the only reason you practice, you know, just for that moment. When you will see and experience parks, palaces, rivers, lotus ponds, mountains of jewels, and wish-fulfilling trees. I'll just take the parks. I don't really need the wish-fulfilling jewels. I'd be happy enough with the parks. At the end of one's life, one feels one has passed away from this world and has been reborn in the next, even though one has not yet died. Whoa, I didn't know that. Thus, by the wonder of the mental realms caused by actions, one will see and experience these events. In the same way, Sudana, by the wonder of these states caused by the actions of an enlightening being, saw that whole supernal manifestation of the Tower of Airochana. So I thought you'd be interested in that. Otherwise, I'm going to skip all the different metaphors. Thus, then the enlightening being Maitreya himself entered the tower, because Sudana was by himself before then, but then Maitreya entered the tower and relaxed his magical force and again snapped his fingers and said to Sudana, arise, this is the nature of things. That's what you just saw. That's the way things really are. The rest is just illusion. That's the way things really are. Things are characterized by non-fixity. Things are stabilized by the knowledge of enlightening beings. Thus, they are inherently unreal and are like illusions, dreams, and reflections. Then, at another finger snap, Sudana emerged from that trance, and Maitreya said to him, did you see the miraculous display of the magical power of enlightening beings? And he said, I saw that. What is the liberation called? And he said, the liberation is called the sanctum of supernal manifestations of unconfused recollection entering into knowledge of all objects of past, present, and future. That's what that's called. And an enlightening being assured of enlightenment in one lifetime attains untold liberations like that. And then my favorite line in the sutra, where has that magnificent display gone? Because it's not there anymore. And Maitreya said, it's gone to where it came from. Where did it come from? It came from the effectuation of the magical power of knowledge of enlightening beings and resides in that very magical power. And then there's more enlightening beings are born in the Buddha's family, they have universal compassion, and so on and so on. And I live in this tower. When I have passed away, I will be born in heaven, and then I'll come down from heaven, and I'll be the Buddha in the next eon. Now, Sudana, go back to Manjushri, where you started, and ask how an enlightening being is to learn and carry out the practices of enlightening being, and he will show you the real benefactor. Why? The best of vows of decillions of enlightening beings is Manjushri's. Vast is the outcome of the practice of Manjushri. Measureless is the accomplishment of the vows of Manjushri. So he goes there, and Manjushri, now we're into Manjushri, which is very short. He extends his hand, or the hand stretches out over 10 miles or so, and puts his hand on Sudana's head, who was standing, I guess, in another city, and says, "Good, good, those without the faculty of faith, those who are weary or sluggish in mind, who have not accumulated efforts, will not be able to practice this. Having caused Sudana to see by means of his spiritual talk, having directed him, inspired him, gladdened him, imbued him with countless factors of truth, illuminated him with the great light of infinite knowledge, led him into the endless mental command, presence of mind, concentration, and super knowledges of enlightening beings, plunged him into the sphere of universally good practice, and established him in his own place." And then he left. As he did the first time. Did you remember that? Manjushri always just sort of disappears. He doesn't stick around very long. By the way, I was reminded in the whole description of all the various towers and Maitreya and Sudana appearing in all the towers. Doesn't that remind you of the story that I always tell every year when we start practice period, which Dogen tells in his fascicle about Ango, about Manjushri and Ma Kashyapa and Manjushri appearing in all these millions of Manjushri appear and millions of Ma Kashyapas appear, because Ma Kashyapa was about to expel Manjushri from the monastery for shoddy conduct. And Buddha then creates this magical thing where there's millions of Manjushris, and Buddha says, "So which one are you going to expel, Ma Kashyapa?" And Ma Kashyapa doesn't know what to do. Okay, exhale. Well, that was fun. So now we're going to hear a word from Shufi. Oh my gosh, look how long that went on. Wow. I wonder if Shufi, if we should wait till next week for you. Could you do that? Because I went on way too long. I wasn't looking at the clock. Not a wise thing to do. Is that okay with you? I don't mean to disappoint you, but you're okay. Yeah, because we have to do our ceremony, and it takes time. So we're a little late. So anybody who has to leave, please go ahead and leave, including those of you online. But the rest of us, we're going to take 5 or 10 minutes to get ready for the ceremony, put on our old cases and whatnot. And thank you for listening, and the end for me.